Welcome to the Sunstone Magazine podcast, where you get the best of Mormon thought and experience in a succinct package. I'm Stephen Carter. This segment is entitled Confessions of an Aging Hypocritical Ex-Missionary by Wayne C. Booth. The late Wayne C. Booth was the George M. Pullman Distinguished Service Professor of English Emeritus at the University of Chicago. He is the author of The Company We Keep, An Ethics of Fiction. This article was published in the March 1998 issue of Sunstone. Until I was far into my teens, I was an utterly unquestioning Mormon. My parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles were all visibly, audibly, aggressively devout. All except one uncle, a smoker, a black sheep. For our family, non-Mormons were beyond the pale. To be tolerated, of course, even treated kindly if they behaved themselves, viewed perhaps as potential converts, but never courted or married, and never even visited socially. They were certainly not destined, like us, to enter the celestial kingdom. We knew that in the next life, those lost souls would not even be allowed to come near us as we continued our eternal progression, pursuing knowledge and righteousness, concepts that, when defined correctly, turned out to be the same thing. What I remember as most important to me was that in heaven, the non-Mormon or non-devout males down there in the lower kingdoms would have no hope for what I had a strong hope for, if I kept my nose clean, becoming the god of another world, accompanied by a pious female helpmate. Meanwhile, here and now, non-Mormons were so far beneath us that it was dangerous to even get near them. I remember feeling scared to walk too close to the one non-Mormon church in my hometown, American Fork, Utah. I would always cross the road and walk on the other side to avoid contamination, and I was thankful that we lived in another ward, far from that wicked place. In short, until my first questioning began at about 14, I was a 100% devotee of what might be called an exclusivist or particularist anti-ecumenical version of Mormonism. That boy, the very young Wayne Booth, would perhaps these days be called by non-Mormons a fundamentalist. The word wasn't in our vocabulary, I'm quite sure. Born and reared in the pre-Darwinian 19th century, as you might say, he was for about 15 years unaware of what had been happening to Western thought from long before he was born. Where am I now? Well, I'm still a Mormon, but one who puts quotation marks around most of my religious commitments. The marks always translated not as disbelief, but as allow me my own definitions. The pious young believer and I have engaged in a variety of dialogues for going on 7 decades. As my beliefs and unbeliefs have shifted about, the debates have, of course, changed ground. At times I have treated the boy as a stupid oaf, and he's treated me as a lost soul. Sometimes he's been so shocked by my ideas, and even more by how low I rank coffee or wine drinking on the scale of sins, that he has simply and angrily cast me off, even as I have lamented his naive commitment to silly superstitions and destructive prejudices. Now, though, as he and I face the many conflicting religious and anti-religious conflicts flooding our world, the distance between us seems to me far less, and the need to get together, in spite of his remaining conviction that that is not possible, seems even greater. After all, I tell him, many of my admired religious friends now talk about an apocalyptical ending fully as confident as he does. And some of them even have in mind, as he does, a second coming. If we can just probe space far enough and vigorously enough, we'll find some planet to escape to when this one collapses. Isn't it time, I now ask my young self, to probe beneath the superficial, verbal differences to the true grounds of our strongest convictions? Isn't our real assignment, as we approach the new millennium, to discover what we share, and then decide, probing our differences, just what can be cast aside? He's a bit more open these days to that suggestion, but for many decades, he viewed my profession of commitment to various liberal versions and virtues of Mormonism as simply a hypocritical disguise for genuine betrayal. You're betraying Grandma and Grandpa Booth, and Grandma and Grandpa Clayson, and great-grandfather and great-grandmother Hawkins, and all the Chipman pioneers. You're casting aside the very testimonies that I've borne in fast and testimony meetings at least 10 times already. You'll make it so we'll not be allowed to talk with any of the family in the next world. Even though you list yourself as a Mormon and who's who, you're not a Mormon anymore. You don't even believe that Mormons have the only true church. You say you believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ and in Joseph Smith as a true prophet, but I know that you mean all that is something covered by a word I just learned in school. It's a metaphor for you, not literal truth. You're just plain hypocritical. And off he rides on his bicycle to go to a Boy Scout meeting, or to collect fast day donations, or to remind the other boys in his deacon's quorum that they must attend both meetings on Sunday, or the other quorum will win the contest for best attendance. Sometimes I can manage, though, to entice him into a real discussion about what beliefs we still share. My claim in those discussions is that he and I still share the most important Mormon truths, the ones that are most truly religious. That radical claim continues to disturb him. I don't see how you can make that claim, and I don't see how we can even discuss it when you arrogantly reject what I know to be true. I just don't want to talk with you. But I go on arguing, as I shall argue here, that beneath our differences, he and I still share common ground that is far more important than our differences. Learning rhetorology, finding common ground, even with enemies, and remaining open to conversation. As I've talked, not just with that young fundamentalist, but with various enemies and other selves over the years, I've been learning the kind of rhetorical practice that these days I risk labeling with a neologism. Rhetorology. Not rhetorical persuasion, but rather a systematic ecumenical probing of the essentials shared by rival rhetorics in any dispute, whether about religion or about other important matters. Though rhetorology shares many features with other dialogical efforts, what it perhaps most resembles is political diplomacy. But unlike skillful diplomats, rhetorologists do not just try to discover the rival's basic commitments and then bargain. Nor do they just tolerate in a spirit of benign relativism. Instead, they search together for true grounds, and then labor to decide how those grounds dictate a change of mind about more superficial beliefs. Any genuine rhetorologist entering any fray is committed to the possibility of conversion to the enemy camp. For decades, I've been especially interested in the quarrels between those who specifically label themselves as religious and who dismiss all atheists as inherently benighted, and many of those who call themselves atheists or unbelievers, and who dismiss all religious talk as nothing more than superstition. As I have struggled to write a book on that subject, my imagined conversations with the lively, probing young believer I once was have come to seem more and more important. For me, the pursuit of such a rhetorology has become a vocation that could be called religious, a kind of faith in or unshakable conviction of the ultimate value of pursuing understanding and improved dialogue about shared fundamental values. The validity of such a faith could never be proved with hard logic or scientific evidence. It is as much a faith as any overt commitment to a church. But in my rhetorical terms, it is both a religious and a rational faith. One that can genuinely be supported by careful argument of the right kind, even though it can be easily described as naive or flatly absurd, according to some narrow notions of rational proof. There are obviously no scientific or strictly logical proofs for the importance of ecumenical, pluralistic probing, but I can find no good reasons to doubt its service to genuine religion. Skeptics concerning this special kind of religious pursuit are found in every field and in most religious groups, and they always find good evidence for their skepticism. Our world is full of evidence showing that attempts at dialogue between contrasting faiths fail more often than they succeed. Think of the failed conversations now going on among, or flatly denied by, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Jews. Indeed, many philosophers and politicians and defenders of religion will claim that there can be no genuine discussion about religion between a pluralist like me and that 14-year-old religious dogmatist. Religious dispute is inherently the kind that gets nowhere. As the self-proclaimed atheist Richard Rorty put it not long ago, religion should be privatized. It should be kept out of the public square. It is bad taste to bring religion into discussions of public policy, because all overtly religious groundings are irrational, refuted by the Enlightenment that he claims still to embrace. In short, I am sure that for him, the faith undergirding the article I'm writing here is absurd. Why should anyone persist in such a faith, looking back on a lifetime and out at a world, both of which seem to exhibit more failures than successes in the search for common spiritual ground? Within the Latter-day Saint community, one seems to see more and more the drawing of sharp, impermeable lines, less and less embrace of the notion that religious devotion expresses itself best when believers get together and think through the grounds of their belief. Of course, there's no way of proving that the lines are sharper now than when I was young, but it is clear that throughout my lifetime, most Mormons would be skeptical about my claim that the young literalist and this old metaphorist belong, in the deepest sense, to the same church. Such a claim might well lead in hundreds of directions. For the rest of this article, I'll pursue just one of them, with the question, where did I pick up a faith as difficult to defend as the faith in what I'm calling rhetorology? Not just ecumenicism, but the pursuit of ecumenical dialogue. Only recently have I begun to suspect that it was the direct result of my 2 years as a confused, probing, often troubled Mormon missionary. Musing on my mission. Though a doubter, I found myself a missionary wanting to believe in the validity of my service. After 5 or 6 years of reading and questioning and privately conferring with pious but unorthodox teachers, as well as heated debates with orthodox and unforgiving authorities, the 20-year-old Wayne Booth, argumentative and increasingly skeptical about many Mormon claims, and even more troubled by the behavior of many saints, surprised a lot of people by accepting a mission call. As he put it to skeptical friends at BYU, but never to the church authorities, he wasn't going out to make converts, not to get people dunked into the baptismal water, but to do good in the world, and to start liberalizing the church from within. Did that feel hypocritical? Yes, indeed. At least some of the time. The key moment of decision went like this, reconstructed nearly 30 years later in 1969, as I wrestled with my religious doubts and convictions in the light of my 18-year-old son's accidental death. Scene: the northwest corner of the Brigham Young University farmland, where the head sluice gates lie. Sluice gates that I manipulate as I irrigate the farm through the long summer hours, reading my pocket Play-Doh as I wait at the end of the furrows for the water to arrive. This evening, Professor M. Wilford Polson has happened by, seen me pulling up a headgate, and stopped his car nearby. After my simple task, I go to his car, place one rubber-booted foot on his fender, and we start talking. We talk and talk. Talk on through the beautiful sunset and into the twilight, slapping mosquitoes, talking mainly about the church and my doubts. Polson: don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You keep leaping ahead into areas you know nothing about. The fact that some church leaders are dishonest or unjust doesn't mean that the church is valueless. Every institution, including every church, has some immoral leaders. Surely you're not going to just relapse into the position that because the church claims to be divinely led and its leaders are clearly not divine, it must be valueless when judged in human terms. Wayne: No, but I don't see any reason to. Poulsen: You shouldn't be looking for reasons to. You should be looking only for reasons not to. Here you are, raised in a marvelously vital tradition, surrounded by an astonishing number of good, intelligent people who have found a way to organize their lives effectively. You come along and ask them for reasons to do what they're doing. What you should ask for before giving up anything they offer you is reasons not to go along. Wayne: But I just can't stand even sitting in church without speaking up when somebody talks nonsense. Last Sunday, they were talking about personal devils, and some of them really believed that stuff. Poulsen: Well, you know what I've always said when some authority grills me on that one. Of course I believe in personal devils. All my devils are personal. It's so unimportant whether you call it devils, or personal quests, or temptations, or schizophrenia. The 55-year-old widower, hated by many students for his nagging discipline in the classroom, mistrusted by the church and university authorities, owner of the best collection of books on Mormon history, he has previously invited me into his basement to have a look at his collection of forbidden sources. Talks on into the dark, feeling lucky, I have no doubt, to have with him one of those rare students who really loves discussing deep questions for hours on end. Of course, I can't see the boy. I only feel myself standing there, chilling a bit in my wet socks, tired after 20 hours of irrigating, not hard labor, admittedly, but still, changing from one foot to the other, and exhilarated beyond description. This is what life can be. This is one of the great times. I'll stay here forever, if only he'll go on talking. Poulsen: What you should be doing, instead of trying to undermine other people's beliefs, is discovering beliefs that you yourself can live by. And you'll find most of them being taught right in the church, by the people you're attacking. That's why I keep saying, show me a better church. I'm not determined to stay with this one. If you'll find me another one that does as much good, and that has fewer corrupt leaders, a better attitude on race or whatnot. Wayne: But that's not good enough. Don't we have the right to hope for an institution that is at least honest with itself? I long for a cause that I can give myself to as fully as the believers, my father and mother, my grandparents could give in earlier times. Poulsen: Well, I'm sure you can find it, if you want to badly enough, because all you have to do is just put your mind to rest and let your emotions take over. Almost any church can easily become that to you if you want it to badly enough. The Mormons have plenty of members like that. All causes do. What they lack is devoted men. I'm pretty sure he did not add women. Who are still willing to think, not just be carried away with sentimentality. What they really need is a core of missionaries who know everything that's wrong about the church, and who don't care, because they know that it can be an instrument for good in their hands. In the dark now, the moon not quite ready to rise, the stars bright as they never seemed to be in 1969. The old man's gray hair is faintly visible inside the car. The deep, thoughtful voice pours out into the night. His dirty fingernails are now invisible, and there is nothing but prophetic voice and silver glow. Wayne: Do you mean to suggest that I should go on a mission? Poulsen: Why not? If you could work not to get people under the water in the greatest possible number, but to take them where you find them and help them to grow, why not? Can you think of a better way to spend 2 years than setting out to help other people with no concern about your own welfare or future? That's what the missionary system is at its best. Oh yes, I admit that it seldom works at its best. Most of the boys are so badly prepared at 19 or 20 that they couldn't even do a good job in the narrow definition of making converts. But you might, if you worked hard, if you thought hard, and if you could keep from worrying too much about your own reputation, you might make a real difference for a lot of people. Just take, for example, the whole question of charity toward backsliders. Who has that in charge in our present setup? None of the other missionaries will be working on that, and you might. Why not? So, at 10 o'clock, they break up, and a few days afterwards, Wayne Clayson Booth accepts the call. Now, here in the late 90s, it's clear that young Booth thus lands himself in rhetorical waters far more turbulent than he ever could have predicted. Even Polson, who had served as a missionary before doing the historical research that for him dissolved the gold plates, could not have predicted what this second-generation Mormon liberal would encounter. From day one, the young Booth had to deal with shock concerning differences between what he believed and what every other missionary believes. His experience in the temple ceremony was so distressing that he almost gave up and went home, and he recorded in great detail the bloodthirsty oaths and other absurdities that were much more prominent in the ceremony then than now. Polson and others had warned him that he would be shocked, but they had understated it. And then he found himself tracting, door to door, struggling to reconcile what the manual said he should teach with what he believed to be the best spiritual food for himself, for his companions, and for prospects who turned up. Now living daily with companions and supervisors who considered what he called the superstitions to be more important than love or charity or any of the other virtues, he found himself inevitably pursuing a practice that he would no doubt have cringed to hear called rhetorology. He became not a mere practitioner of persuasion, a rhetor trying to win converts to his views, and not the mere student of how people persuade, a rhetorician, but a rhetorologist. How can I reconcile their rhetoric with mine, their surface codes with what I'm sure are shared beliefs that are more important than all of those conflicting literal claims? Elder Booth got to be pretty good at some amateur versions of rhetorology, sometimes in ways that his younger self, still surviving his conscience, damned as hypocritical. He somehow didn't get far on liberalizing the whole church from within, but he did learn how to pray in public in a language that accommodated the literalists without violating his own meditations. He learned how to give sermons that woke some people up, undermined their cliches, and led them to dwell on the central virtues and limits of Mormonism without leading, most of the time, to angry attacks against him for unorthodoxy. He learned how to learn from the Orthodox what was really valuable in their orthodoxy. He did so well at it that the liberal mission president, Leo J. Meir, absorbed in Egyptian numerology rather than rhetorology, chose him as mission secretary at headquarters in Chicago. He even felt some sense of triumph as he returned home in January of 1944, at last facing the draft. How I wish I had a transcript of the celebratory talk he gave at his homecoming sacrament meeting. Not of one mind. How could I reconcile my liberal skepticism with my calling as a missionary? That description of what he learned about dealing with rival rhetorics is much simpler and more cheerful than the picture I find in his journals of the time, full as they are of the vast swings from up to down and back again. Sometimes he's in despair, sometimes he finds himself cursing under his breath when listening to prayers that he considers not just stupid, but wicked. Only rarely does he write openly in the daily accounts of the rhetorical problems he faces as he deals with the surrounding orthodoxy. He slogs it out for 2 solid years, much of the time wrestling in his journal over the question of just which remaining religious ideas, if any, he can embrace. Like the history of many probers through their youth, his account reveals great swings from doubt to belief and back again, sometimes sounding absurd to me now, sometimes a bit pathetic, sometimes fairly impressive, depending partly on my mood as I reread. Often the journals reveal conflicts between the gods of scientific truth and the rival gods of moral and political service. If you care about the truth of things, I find him implying again and again, you ought to quit this mission. If you care about human welfare, now or in the future, if you care about helping people, you should continue. Most striking to me are the ways in which Elder Booth labors to reconcile diverse views of religion and science in his missionary journal. When he reads Henri Bergson's Creative Evolution, for example, a book then touted by liberal believers, his response is that of a would-be believer rescued from the seas of doubt. Quote, September 5th, 1942. Bergson is magnificent, especially where he's obviously wrong or only guessing. Bergson is righter than most philosophers. Bergson is a man after my own heart. He says that evolution does not come about through natural selection, but through the existence of an original vital impetus, elan vital, which is consciousness, or life, pushing upward against materiality, which naturally is descending. Through intuition and not through intellect, we can discover this elan vital. There is no limit in time to the impetus. It may even transcend death. It is a becoming, as is all movement, and the aim of philosophy should be to turn inward toward this becoming in order to apprehend, in order to follow its present results. Unquote. The scientist in him, he had enrolled in BYU intending to become a chemist, of course, raises doubts. Bergson carries himself away in his enthusiasm, he writes, and uses specious reasoning instead of real proof. But what is palpable is the relief Booth feels at having found a reasonable argument for a new version of religious commitment. Quote, one of my reasons for liking Bergson is the beautiful way in which he suits my recent conversion to spirituality, my reversion from materialism, unquote. As he goes on reading Bergson and mystics such as Aldous Huxley and religious psychologists such as Carl Jung, his joy is palpable as he experiences a, quote, feeling of oneness and sympathy for all life and especially all human life, the feeling of a creative and impelling force greater than oneself, unquote. Elder Booth reports his pride in being able to do so without violating the tiny bits of irreligious or scientific knowledge that he thinks he has. But the threats of hard reason are never far removed. Quote, increased knowledge will surely supplant or modify much of Bergson's metaphysics. His jet of life or energy or whatever it was must be little more than pure fancy. Quite probably, his big idea of the consciousness and its instrumentality on matter is faulty, but that consciousness now transcends matter and can transcend it more in the future will not be refuted, I hope. Unquote. In entry after entry, I find Elder Booth struggling to reduce the dissonance between religious belief and rationally defensible belief. Armed with Bergson and Plato, and later, Jung, who says that he's never known a psychological problem that was not essentially a religious problem, Elder Booth can sometimes, with a clear conscience, liberalize whatever seems ready to be liberalized as it comes his way. Quote, September 8th, 1942. Last night, Clive Bradford, a fellow missionary, and I had a long talk about the church, philosophy, the war, and the missionary system. Brad is an intelligent fellow, original in his thinking. I've had him reading Hawking and Will Durant and James's Varieties of Religious Experience, unquote. That's the tone of a young would-be wise man spreading his mature harmonics to the world. The best critic of such pomposities was his favorite mission companion, Marion Duff Hanks. Duff provided brilliant challenges to most of his ideas, radical and conservative, and later provided the best possible model of what it means to be a totally devoted and active, yet liberal, Mormon. As everyone says who knew Duff well, he should have been made one of the 12. Meanwhile, as the idiosyncratic mission drags on, the self-divided missionary takes refuge many hours each week in literature and music, sometimes with conscious reference to religious problems, but often simply lost in the joys of art. But almost every day, he wrestles with religious questions. He says that he has discovered that every person is, quote, a walking bundle of ineffability, a bit like God himself, unquote, by which he apparently means that the existential riches of each person finally escapes any attempt at description. Forget about conceptual problems, essentially irresolvable, and revel in the riches God's world offers you. He reads Ulysses. Can you picture it, reader? That young missionary moving from Orthodox testimony meetings to James Joyce's nighttown scenes and back to the meetings. The, quote, most clever, most intellectual, most sophisticated book I've ever read. Of course, by my definition of intellectual and sophisticated, I exclude practically everything before the 19th century, though in reality they may require more downright intelligence, the great ones, than any of the moderns, unquote. And then he goes on wrestling with the church he had hoped to rescue. As his first long year draws to a close, he gets the idea of organizing the liberals. Quote, if all the so-called Mormon liberals could organize, some beneficial changes could be wrought. Might even be just plain made without having to be wrought. But I'm sure it would be much more effective if they were wrought. Unquote. But then, in a long, fascinating paragraph, most of which I'll spare you, he describes the differences among the liberals and concludes that, quote, the group who think as I do probably numbers no more than 20 at the most. And of course, this is the right way, and all the others will eventually come to our position, of course. Yes, we are a hodgepodge, the larger group of liberals, of malcontents, and will probably never get together, unquote. By the middle of Elder Booth's first year, the original reasons for becoming a missionary have grown rather dim. But the steady battle for intellectual freedom goes on, unofficial, never clearly formulated. In late December, 11 months in, quote, putting off the critique of Ulysses, unquote, the boy decides to, quote, tabulate and mull over my various interests, unquote. And he proceeds to do so in 3 single-spaced typed pages. After some preliminary efforts at humor, one page, he finally begins what, from the perspective here, could almost be described as a dialogue among 3 rival gods: truth, reality, goodness, human progress, individual and social, and beauty, the religion of art then dominating the lives of many he most admired. Quote, my primary interest is to get closer to reality, or I could say, I am interested in philosophy. I could profitably spend my whole time giving myself a rigorous philosophical education, working out a stable, personal, philosophical position, getting at the truth of this mysticism business. This is partly intellectual curiosity, but more it's something akin to aesthetic yearnings. I want something, the right, real thing to replace the religion philosophy of my childhood. I think that the mystics and the humanists and the scientific materialists all have vital things still to say to me, and I wish I could be with them constantly. Among my deepest interests is my passion, please let me call it that and don't laugh, for great fiction and poetry. For instance, I could spend my whole time reading novels and training myself to write them, or at least to criticize them intelligently. Also in this quest for reality category is science, the much abused and much misunderstood bane and joy for all modern thinkers. Really, my first intellectual love, it still looms large in my horizon. I leave it alone. When you spend time reading this book, you just can't be reading that book, far more than I should. Because, certainly, with all my mystical leanings, I must keep a firm grasp on the genuine truth which science discovers. Less ethereal, less theoretical, is my interest in politics. I'm subject to spasms of political conscience, the feeling that I should go actively into some liberal movement, unquote. And then, after adding music and art to these passions, he makes a slight bow to his missionary work. Quote, missionary work. I neglect it horribly. Always able to justify myself by saying, well, I'm not really ready for mature missionary work yet. What do I know? What can I teach? Unquote. And so the debates among the rival gods go on, each aspiring to replace or at least subdue features of the god he had once embraced without question. Sometimes he sounds like an arrogant prophet of the Enlightenment, with no self-doubt whatever. But more often, it's a dance back and forth, up and down. January 4th, 1943. 1 year to go. After several pages on music, art, and literature, quote, T.Y., his cousin then in the army, and I are still arguing somewhat futilely about the gospel. I find myself totally unable to convince him that when he persists in believing every detail of the Joseph Smith story, he is being gullible and intellectually immature. I can't muster in sufficient force the long string of reasons for my present opinions to convince him. His difficulty is that he thinks he's passed through the doubting period, that he has reached the final, firm ground of belief, and that I am where he was when he doubted. That is totally untrue. At the time he doubted, it was merely youthful questioning curiosity, show-me-ness, the same kind I experienced at about the same time. He cannot see that the unfirm ground on which I now tread is an entirely different intellectual bog from the one he once wallowed in. He says to me, what is your concept of God? I can't give it to him clearly. He says, what kind of future life do you envision if the Mormon position is unacceptable for you? I can't answer. He wonders why I doubt miracles. I can't give him acceptable reasons. He believes in a personal God. He is therefore justified in allowing that God does miracles. One of those miracles could logically be the establishment of the church. All of my pointing out of irrationalities or inconsistencies does no good. In the first place, he's a clever talker and can find explanations less far-fetched than the usual kind used for apologetics. In the second place, he can accuse me of trying to make religion rational, which it is not. And I must admit that my kind of religion is more irrational than his. And so we go the pointless rounds. He in Australia, I in Chicago. It's good clean sport and hurts neither of us, although he wants to convince me more than I want to convince him, since according to his doctrine, I am deliberately retarding myself. Still, he does not get dogmatic with me, and he is a great relief from the regular arguments I get on religion. January 29th, 1943. The Partisan Review arrived, a section of three articles, The New Failure of Nerve by J. Dewey and two other almost as acute Joes, made me realize even more fully than I've done before that I can't accept anyone's philosophy but my own. Their devastating comments in criticism of the so-called swing to religion were acceptable and devastating. But their criticisms of Niebuhr and Hawking was more hard to take. But I had to admit the justice of many of the things they said, especially since I had said some of the same things myself. Things they object to. A. Attempts to discard the scientific method or to discredit it in social and political situations. B. Arguments about original sin, whether literal or symbolical. Believing, they say, that man is irrevocably limited because he is not God, inevitably discourages attempts to eliminate the limits which can be eliminated. C. The idea that since man's absolutes are usually, if not always, fallible, a divine absolute should be cooked up. They, of course, completely reject the idea of God. But if one accepts the Mormon theology, eternal progression of each man until he himself attains godhood, this one objection to God is done away with. As is quite general with me lately, I am unable to come to a decision. Nor can I even accept a probability. I rather lean toward the rationalists, while still seeing that much of their certitudes are mythical, as Santayana would admit that they are. Unquote. And then, only 2 days later, quote, Santayana, with all his naturalism, says more favorable things about religion, even dogmatic religion, than I would be able to. What is worse, he convinces me of the justice of his comments, thus making me apologetic for all the time I've spent condemning my religion and my people. How to know where to draw lines? That's the goal of the Life of Reason. And because Santayana has never had to break away from a conventional belief on his own initiative, he doesn't realize the difficulties involved in drawing lines. He acts as though any halfway sensible person would be able to work out his compromises gracefully and quietly, without fanfare even in a diary. Unquote. Naturally, Elder Booth's guilt about his hypocritical missionary work frequently almost chokes him. March 16, 1943. Quote, in trying to detect any particular theme running through my dreams each night, I find only one. I am a fake and in danger of being found out. One night I'm back at my irrigation doing my usual half-hearted job, not knowing where to go next nor when the water will get out of control, cheating the university, which in reality I did. I had sometimes charged them for more hours than I spent, even as they cheated me by paying only 25 cents an hour. Next night, I'm claiming 5 pictures in an art gallery as my own, when in reality they are not. I stalk through my dream trying to avoid questions about my method of work, knowing I cannot answer them intelligently. I even forget which are mine, and am in fear that someone will ask me, and so on. Another night, I am a crook going to high school, and I get discovered and have to shoot my way out. Unquote. April 6, 1943. Quote, one possibility in explaining these dreams, considered rather belatedly after trying out some others, is the essential hypocrisy of my present mission. Unquote. Preaching the pluralist religion. Having come to terms with a pluralistic universe, I confront the reality of war. What I find most revealing about this missionary record is the way in which all of that inner turmoil slowly begins, as the 2 years draw to a close, to resolve itself into more aggressive attempts at conscious rhetorology. One could say that, without quite knowing it, the young man was discovering the pluralist religion that sparks my life now, the passion for furthering multiple, always partial understandings of a world, a cosmos, a God, that who somehow deserves to be understood and commands that we both try to understand it and live according to its standards, even while it remains beyond any one formula. The journal entries are still predominantly about other matters, mainly Booth's own spiritual struggles, but there are many clues about his growing passion for effective dialogue, for the struggle to pursue the overstanding that can sometimes be found under various stands. October 2nd, 1943. Quote, I neglected to mention, I believe, the speech I gave at the North Shore Ward last week. I was in my old stride, at my best, perfectly at ease and composed. I yet had them intensely interested all the way, one can tell such things, and I think that I really made them think. My subject was some of the faults which prevent Mormons from making what they could of themselves. It was never thus expressed, but that's what it was. I gave it to them straight, and I believe there was only one member who didn't like it, and even he seemed interested. I'm a little disappointed with myself for not having given more such good accounts of myself while on my mission. I hardly ever mention my mission and my opinion of it here, in this journal. That is, I suppose, partly because I'm generally quite discouraged about the little I have accomplished. I enjoy myself around my Mormon associates now more than ever before. I think the Mormon people are good people, and I think that I am what I am, including the few good parts, largely as a result of the Mormon environment. Yet, I've been discouraged by the difficulties in the way of intellectual improvement among my people. The Mormon ideology is so firmly rooted in superstition that it seems impossible to ever separate the two. Despite all my apologetics, one is simply not a Mormon unless one believes in the literal divinity of the Book of Mormon, any more than one is a Christian unless one believes in the literal Christ Jesus. In general, I'd have to say that I'm glad that I came on my mission, though it has been far different from anything I expected. But then, the last year or so of any active life always seems very valuable in retrospect. I still have in mind doing a book about and for Mormons, analyzing our faults, proposing future attitudes, clearing away dead beliefs. My big problem now is, shall I continue with my people as a hypocrite? Shall I openly express my doubts and take my chances with my group? Or shall I completely break away? As I see it now, the last named is completely impossible. I love too many Mormons. November 12th, 1943. Went down to a kind of miserable defeat tonight on trying to give an original Thanksgiving talk to the MIA of Logan Square Ward. I tried to get them to think about real Thanksgiving. I'm sure it fell completely flat, partly because of poor treatment. I hadn't thought it through hard enough. Partly because of the people's sentimental desire to stay within the set form of Thanksgiving thought, unquote. With a mission that everyone else considered highly successful drawing to a close, he goes on attending concerts and visiting art galleries. Soon he begins taking courses part-time at the University of Chicago, completely counter to mission rules, but that liberal president, Leo J. Meir, has no objections. And he goes on reading and reading and reading. He reads Fawn Brody's Life of Joseph Smith, alternating between total credulity and strong doubts. He falls in love with Blake's London, memorizes it, and quotes it entirely in the journal, commenting on the mind-forged manacles that he feels still binding him. Quote, in every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mind-forged manacles I hear. Unquote. January 7th, 1943. Quote, we are all conscript minds, but in different armies, and none of us are striving to be free, but each to make his own conscription universal. Santayana is right. Blake is right. Yet there are some who work free at least most of the manacles, some who become conscientious objectors in the conscription of the mind. If I didn't think that I had, in part, cast off some of the manacles, I would have less hope of ever achieving any degree of greatness of spirit. But the distance ahead is indicated by nothing more than my own complicity in the Jewish matter. The news about the Nazi atrocities was getting clearer and clearer. With all my sincere horror and sympathy, with all my subscriptions to refugee societies and talking and debate, with all my reiterated concern about a society that allows mass brutality and does nothing until attacked, I find myself guilty, as I have found myself guilty 100 times before, on the score of personal selfishness of the sort that has caused the war, personal desire for acclaim of the sort that breeds politicians and Hitlers, intolerance of the sort that persecutes Jews. Musing in this way leads one easily, unless one is careful, into nonsense about original sin. Very few can ever maintain a true central position. Man is neither good nor bad. He is both good and bad. He is eternally damned, and he has eternal possibilities of salvation. Mankind as a whole will not go down to bestiality tomorrow to please Albert J. Nock or Alfred Kazin, nor will mankind achieve tomorrow any sort of genuinely brave new world, with everyone being superhuman. Not even with social ills eliminated. Not even with war eliminated, I'm afraid. But I know empirically that men can improve. I have actually improved myself. They can learn. They can sublimate their selfish desires, to use a corny phrase. They can, in short, progress, whether they have done so or not in the past. Unquote. And with this, the young unbeliever, who yet believed in progress, in the validity of the scientific method, and the continuing triumphs of science, in the possibility of development of a beautiful spirit of man, in free will, though some versions of science threaten this one especially strongly, in the moral truth that it is always in all cultures wrong to hurt others, in the inherent value of a Mormon upbringing, that young man, radically confused not just about the problem of original sin, but about almost everything, as I see it in 1998 in my utterly unconfused state of mind, that young man completed his assigned 2 years as a designated clergyman and was then belatedly drafted into World War II. For 2 long years, then, Elder Booth had been learning, without knowing that he was learning, the arts of rhetorology. As some of the skeptical Mormons he knew gave up their skepticism and returned to orthodoxy, and others pushed it further and broke with the church, he chose, as I still choose, to pursue the ground shared by both the Orthodox and the diverse brands of the unorthodox. As M. Wilford Polson had taught him to say, every Mormon trusts his own unorthodoxy. Just as I pray daily to God with full devotion, hoping for salvation, grant me my special definitions all the way, so I am now still a devoted Latter-day Saint. That confession meets some difficulties when I add that I also believe in my version of Judaism, Catholicism, and Quakerism, not to mention my even more ignorant versions of Buddhism and Hinduism, and the 3 disguised secular, even atheistic religions I am trying to write about in that book on the rhetorics of official and disguised religions. Coming home to common ground. Why I feel grateful for 2 years of hypocritical strivings. Why did the young wanderer not feel guilty, except sometimes, about the hypocrisy implied by the vigorous accommodation to the audience required to serve as a Mormon missionary? Why do I not feel guilty now, except sometimes, about the innumerable other accommodations to the audience that my rhetorological inquiries have required? Why did I not then, and do not now, feel like a mere waffler? Why, in short, do I now feel grateful for those 2 years of hypocritical strivings, to say nothing of the decades of hypocritical to and froing that followed? 3 main reasons have been implicit throughout here. First, those years converted me to my lifetime religion of rhetorology, though even the word rhetoric never occurred at the time. I was learning daily just how deceptive our habitual dichotomies can be. Believers, unbelievers, religious, atheistic, good, evil, saved, damned. And I was learning some of the crucial techniques for breaking into and dissolving such misleading dichotomies. It was not a matter of theoretical inquiry. It was a daily practice that developed habits of probing what I later learned to call topoi, or topics, in the Aristotelian sense of shared places or groundings that underlie surface disputes. It was only when I was required in graduate school to dig into Aristotle's treatment of topics that my practice of good and bad versions of hypocrisy became a subject for conscious intellectual inquiry. I can remember working toward an MA 4-hour examination on Aristotle's rhetoric, suddenly realizing, oh, that's what I've been up to. The old dismissive term commonplaces suddenly became crucial, as Aristotle distinguished the common topics, commonplaces, loosely defined spaces that all people share, and special topics, spaces that only practitioners in a given specialty share. Consider some examples of common or shared topics and special topics. All readers of Sunstone share many topics, commonplaces, call them universals if you prefer, with Catholics and Muslims and atheists, and indeed, almost everybody. For example, to get more of whatever is really good is better than to get less of it. But, on the other hand, and in potential conflict, it is wrong to harm a close friend, even if to do so will get you more of something you want. More narrowly, Mormon readers of Sunstone share with one another, and with readers of the Ensign, certain somewhat more special topics. For example, in our culture, it is better to be able to read and think about religious questions than not to be able to. And some ways of reading are better than other ways. And to read about Mormonism is more important than reading about baseball scores. And to involve oneself with religion and religious questions is an essential part of any good life. Any disagreements so far? Finally, most readers of Sunstone share certain, even more specialized topics not shared with many other subcultures. For example, you're likely to be a better Mormon and a better person if you think deeply about your beliefs and exercise free agency than if you accept blindly, without thought, whatever this or that authority says. And too many important questions don't get treated in official Mormon publications. Being my kind of missionary didn't teach me to think quite like that of commonplaces, but it built the habits that made such thinking finally indispensable, and it taught me implicitly the connection between those habits and the religious command to love our fellow creatures. I was learning to worship, or serve, that deepest of all human values that I celebrate here: genuine understanding, sympathetic, serious listening, the loving act of entering the spiritual domain of other human beings, those who, these days, tend to be labeled the other. Nothing we ever work at, the young man was discovering, is more important than the drive not just to maintain peace with rivals or enemies or misguided friends, not to just tolerate them generously, not to just condescend to them with a benign smile, but to understand them, to learn to think with them, while assisting them to think with us in return. That became his definition of love. Love not just as belief, but as an intellectual spiritual practice. In effect, that became his definition of God's missionary assignment. Second, in teaching rhetorology as a loving practice, those years saved me from a frequently powerful impulse to cast off the church, or to get the authorities to cast me off. Unlike some friends who could discern no middle ground and consequently leapt off into being not just Jack Mormons, but non or even anti-Mormons, I found that my search for shared ground removed all reasons for a break. Increasingly, I discovered that most of what I most deeply believed was derived from Mormon teachings. Do what is right, let the consequence follow. Have I done any good in the world today? If not, I have failed indeed. All is well, all is well. Though ensuing decades yielded many moments of radical doubt about various notions of God and various choices made by Mormon authorities, I never came to doubt that Mormonism is one of the true religions. Third, and perhaps most important, as we think about the various forms of hypocrisy thriving within the church today, my hypocritical years taught me the inherent value of one kind of hypocrisy, what I have elsewhere termed hypocrisy upward. The word hypocrisy originally meant playing a role on the stage, and it is clear that all of us, at least some of the time, are playing out roles we think appear superior to what we really are. Every parent tries to play a role that he or she knows is to some degree doctored, purified for the child's consumption. Every teacher knows that the self who stands before the class is an utterly different and usually superior person as compared with the one who the night before swore over her income tax returns or slapped his 5-year-old daughter. If we did not rise above our everyday selves in that way, hypocritically enacting superior selves, our culture would collapse much faster than even the most cynical see it as collapsing today. While not defending such acting out when it is used to exploit others, should we not defend it when it helps us practice being characters superior to our ordinary selves, thus learning how to be such characters? When I hypocritically act like a person of saintly generosity, am I not learning how to be generous? When I hypocritically enact the role of someone who believes in a belief I question, am I not likely to discover that thinking in that previously detested way actually makes sense? Everyone who succeeds in any practice experiences such hypocrisy upward somewhere along the line. You know you're not a good public speaker, but when assigned to give a talk, you pretend to be the best speaker you've ever heard, and you give a better talk than you thought you could. You know that you do not possess the full range of virtues required for a given church position, but you accept the calling, act out those virtues, and soon discover that you're actually developing at least some of them. By pretending to be another better person, you have become another better one. You know that you are not a perfect surgeon, but you put on airs to show that you aspire to be. What my practice of rhetorology as a missionary taught me was that if I pretended to listen sympathetically to beliefs I detested, I would sometimes discover that they were better beliefs than those I had held when entering the discussion. And even when that did not happen, my hypocrisy upward, or outward, did at least broaden and deepen my own grasp of the world and how we limited creatures can deal with its mysteries. I hope it is clear that nothing I've said suggests that all religious or Mormon views, open or disguised, are, in my view, equally defensible. The point of rhetorological dialogue is not relativistic tolerance, but genuine progress toward truth. Some religious commitments save, some destroy. Some hypocritical efforts to listen can reveal beliefs even worse than they appeared at the beginning. To take in or act out the other with full empathy, learning to think with the other, is no surefire route either to self-improvement or to brightening some one corner of the world's darkness. And when rhetorical probing is used to exploit the other, as Tartuffe's brilliant imitations of piety are used, the practice cannot be called rhetorology, but chicanery. But surely, our world would be better if more of our brothers and sisters, more of the time, would practice not the kind of lying, self-aggrandizing hypocrisy so prevalent around us, but hypocrisy upward. The aspiration, through taking on roles or taking in the other, that produces genuine understanding. Would not the church itself be radically improved if more of us, not just lowly active members and peripheral hangers-on, but the highest authorities too, would really listen lovingly to the enemy long enough and closely enough to discover what is really there? That concludes Confessions of an Aging Hypocritical Ex-Missionary by Wayne C. Booth. That concludes this episode of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Encourage your friends to join us by becoming a patron at patreon.com/sunstone. If you would like to further support Sunstone's efforts, visit sunstone.org/donate, where you can make a tax-deductible contribution. We'll be back soon with another installment of the best of Mormon thought and experience. Thanks for listening.